completo de lunes a jueves. You'll find it.
The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Larry, fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
Larry. Larry.
Come on, Larry. Larry.
What's that? That is the sound of autumn. My favorite season. Falling leaves, geese winging south, a bonfire on a chilly night. As a kid, I always claimed my favorite was summer, but I was conning myself. Sure, I loved the feel of wet sand beneath my feet, riding the waves, the cry of gulls overhead, the tang of salt air in my nose, the boardwalk cacophony, and of course, bikini-clad girls to the horizon. That was beach summer. A few of those were spent on the Jersey Shore. By the way, everybody called it the Jersey Shore, especially people who lived on the Jersey Shore. But I didn't know there were exclusive enclaves where some pretentious assholes found the abbreviation Jersey gauche. Many years later, as an adult, in a business lunch in Los Angeles, I found myself across the table from a pompous ass who had mentioned he was originally from the Garden State. Trying to jumpstart a conversation, I asked him whereabouts in Jersey. He answered, "From a place where they call it New Jersey, not Jersey." I let his little zinger slide. Had it not been a business thing, I'd have asked him if that place was Secaucus, a shithole town so odious you need a gas mask to make it through alive, even at 70 miles an hour. But I didn't. It was business. Gotta keep things civil. Keep it light. Being L.A., when we left the restaurant, of course, there was valet parking. Only in Los Angeles can you drive 20 miles for a meal and then have to pay some guy to drive the last 20 feet. I got into my unspectacular company car. The valet brought him his Porsche Boxster, of course, so we could head home to Palos Verdes, a pricey area near the sea. The guy rubbed me the wrong way from the moment I met him. But not too long after that lunch, he was arrested for embezzlement, fraud, and tax evasion. His trophy wife left him. Creditors seized his car and his home, and he traded in his Brioni threads for an orange jumpsuit. I always meant to reach out to him in prison, ask him if he called his new home a prison or a penitentiary, but I never got around to it. But back to the seasons, yeah, summer was great, beach summer. Sometimes the old man would load us into the Impala and head for my Uncle John's place in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York. That was another flavor of summer. Cornfields and pastures and dairy farms and forests and lakes brimming with fish. Best of all, no matter how hot the day in July, or even dog days of August, the nights were cool. Good sleeping. No AC was necessary. On many evenings, Uncle John would fire up the grill, throw on steaks and fresh-picked corn from the farm down the road. Tomatoes, right from his own garden, too. We'd feast like kings. Sometimes we'd all pile into his big-ass Mercury. He was always a Mercury or Ford guy. And he'd drive us into town for dessert, which was usually ice cream at an old-time soda fountain. With plenty of daylight left, he'd take the long way home with the windows open on that Merc. It was a visual and an olfactory banquet. Deer darting through the woods, trout jumping at flies, the smell of fresh mown hay. There was nothing like that in the concrete and asphalt sprawl of Queens, New York. He was a big outdoorsman. Field and Stream guy. He knew all the back roads to the best fishing spots and hunting grounds. One time he took us way down a dirt road, then he stopped in the middle of nowhere. Off in those woods, you could see it. A still, yeah, with a big tank and copper coil wire, like something out of the Smoky Mountains in the 1930s. I don't remember if it was located in some dry county or the moonshiners just liked the kick of do-it-yourself whiskey, but it was a pretty cool sight. And maybe my uncle knew more than he was telling. By early September, if there were any getaways to be had from Queens, the Jersey Shore was the place to be, and not just for the beach. Yeah, the water, it was still warm enough for swimming, and the crowds, they'd thin out after Labor Day. Prices dropped, too, at motels, restaurants. When the vacationers cleared out, the real attractions flooded in. Lunker, bluefish. A lot of big game fishermen agree that pound for pound, blues are the hardest fighting fish in the sea. They're not acrobats like tarpon or bonefish. Blues specialize in blunt force trauma. When they reach maturity, in early fall, they travel in massive schools. They'll run up to 20 pounds or more and never vary more than a few ounces in weight, reason being, they're cannibals. Their nickname is choppers, and they will bite anything in their path. When they're younger, maybe 7 to 10 pounds, they tend to vomit when you boat them. I've seen them puke up ring tabs from beer cans, hooks, lures, and dozens of smaller fish, some still squirming, proving they swallow them whole. By the time they reach full size, a 20-pound bluefish will snap 30, 40, even 50-pound test line like it's silk thread. When they hit your bait, they deliver a jolt that's astonishing. Reel one in, you'll know you've been in a fight, and your shoulders will ache. Once in a while, the line will go slack and you think he spit the hook, but when you retrieve your rig, you find only a head. The rest of him is in some shark's belly, or maybe his buddy's bellies. The brutality of the sea is fascinating. I devoted episode 113 to an epic fishing trip. It's called A Twisted Fish Tale, and you can find it in the July 2018 tab at thatlarryshow.com. And if you'd like more on my mountain adventures at Uncle John's, check out episode 123. Larry visits a secret club and learns the secret of life. The title is no exaggeration. You'll dig the show. It's in the September 2018 tab. When the bluefish are running big off the Jersey Shore, the Catskill Mountains, well, they're getting chilly during the day and downright cold at night. The few times we visited Uncle John in autumn, there was no barbecue outside on the patio. My Aunt Stell would make a pot roast in the oven. There'd be no ice cream run after dinner either. It was too dark and too cold. But truth be told, for reasons I've yet to figure out, autumn is my favorite season. Not a Maine or Yukon autumn, which can be like winter in Antarctica. I mean, autumn in southern New England or the eastern Sierras or maybe Kentucky or Tennessee. Autumn where there's no need of chains on your tires or long johns. Autumn light. Even as a kid, I loved autumn, despite that dreadful handicap called school. School sucked. Grammar and high school were long on gloom and discipline and short on fun. Although I managed to find cool Confederates who refused to be stifled or broken by the system. While other kids built friendships on mutual interests in sports or music or the chess club or mathletes or booze or drugs, ours was founded on the delight we derived from beating the system, getting over on them, confounding their command and control. Many days at school, I felt more like some black ops guy and a student. I suppose it's a feeling shared by second story men and safecrackers. It's not merely the tangible rewards of the job, it's the thrill of evading detection, of foiling all security measures, and then watching authority scurry around, chasing their own tails as they try to solve the crime or the mystery. On the first day of freshman year, they took mugshots of everyone for the photo ID card. Now, many little idiots were thrilled by this, comparing their cards to others.
Look at me, I'm a member of something.
I saw it for what it was. A fucking plastic leash and a way to track you or punish you. The term vaccine passport was decades in the future, but the principle was the same. Without your ID card, you were invalid. Or to alter the accent of the syllables, you were an invalid. You had to show that ID card to get into the school in the morning, to get into the cafeteria, which offered the shittiest food imaginable, to get into a ball game or the library, or most critically, one of the few dances held each year where there was an opportunity to meet, speak to, maybe even hold a female. But if you were a bad boy, first thing they do is confiscate your ID card. Presto! Invalidation. My two pals, Jimmy and Frank, were fantastic co-conspirators. Not only had they nerves of steel, they also adhered to the code of Omerta. Though we were never caught at any of our hijinks, there was no concern of being ratted out. They were solid dudes. They, too, despised the ID cards and all they represented. We weren't exactly thieves. Thieves keep what they steal. We'd steal just to see if we could get away with it and then return the ill-gotten gain, usually without the owner ever knowing it was gone. Like our Spanish teacher's Plymouth satellite. Jimmy once lifted his keys, had them duped during lunch, and returned them to the guy's briefcase so he was none the wiser. But that ignition key with a Mopar star on it, well, that called to Jimmy every day. It was burning a hole in his pocket. One day at lunch, I was heading to a deli across the street, and suddenly, a familiar car pulled up at the curb in front of me. It was a Spanish teacher's satellite with Jimmy at the wheel. Holy shit, he did it! The car was slightly hot-rodded. Spring lifters on the ass end and thrush pipes along the rocker panels and pins with cables on the hood. Jimmy had one arm out the window, his aviator shades on and a wooden match in the corner of his mouth like Bob Mitchum in Thunder Road. I asked him what the hell he was doing. He answered, "Hey Lorenzo, don't ask me what I'm doing. Obviously, I already did it. The question is, where am I going? And the answer is, Rockaway." Rockaway was the nearest beach. I flashed on a police pursuit, handcuffs, bail bonds, and my parents' tear-streaked faces. Then I told Jimmy to have a fun time. Later that afternoon, I looked out the second floor window and noticed the satellite gliding back into its parking spot. Teacher never knew his car had gone to the beach. Talk about a victimless crime. I suppose Jimmy did owe the guy a couple gallons of gas. Doubtless that joyride was a rush for Jimmy, but it lacked something. Something many of our other escapades produced. Watching authority go batshit. At the scene of the crime, we needed a fresh and outrageous undertaking that would rock their world. We retired to our private office, a storage room above the stage in the auditorium, which we sometimes kept stocked with cold beer. Yes, yes, this was high school, probably junior year. We were way too cool for stupid and potentially tragic shit like bomb threats or false alarms. We didn't want to hurt anyone. We just wanted to put a bug up their asses. We shot down ideas as fast as we came up with them. Finally, the last bell rang. was time to go home. The calendar was right around now, late October. Already I was wearing my faux shearling bombardier jacket, looking like a crewman on a B-17. As I neared the subway entrance, I could not bear to descend into that dank hole in the ground. I decided to walk home, or at least to the second or third subway stop. I turned that big collar up to the chill and jammed my hands deep in the pockets. There were a few small trees on Queens Boulevard. As I trudged past them, I noticed a few brown and purple leaves still clinging to nearly barren branches. It was gusty as hell. Whirlwinds of dust and dry leaves and newspapers swirled around my shoes as I walked. For some odd reason, the song Tubular Bells, theme of the ultimate horror movie, The Exorcist, it was stuck in my head. Maybe that movie began in fall and those dry leaves triggered the song. As I walked, my subconscious fitted together the pieces of the puzzle forming in my mind. This was a Catholic school, very big on groupthink and rigid discipline. In fact, there was a faculty member whose title was actually Dean of Discipline. He had a license to slap faces or kick or paddle asses as he saw fit, and he did, with regularity. Nearly the entire faculty of the school was robe-wearing Roman Catholic brothers. Every classroom had a crucifix and statue of Mary or Joseph. A prayer was said before each class, before lunch, basketball games, you name it. They found a way to underpin everything with religion, which was not a bad thing. Better than the Marxist shit they now drill into young minds. But religion was the core, the center, the gravitational pull, the raison d'etre for the entire school. A red light and traffic stopped my march at a big intersection. The crosswind blew even more fiercely, and I shut my eyes against a barrage of dust that actually stung my face. As it eased up, I opened my eyes. The western sky was autumnal glory, streaked with orange and pink with a slash of bright silver where the sun was staging its last hurrah for the day. That was when I flashed on it as tubular bells reached a crescendo in my head. The Eureka moment. We would stage a black mass. That would give them seizures. I was fucking giddy with my own brilliance. I practically levitated as I trotted the entire distance home, which had to be 4 or 5 miles. At dinner, I inexplicably laughed to myself. Mom and Dad asked me what was so funny. I could hardly tell them. They looked concerned. The next day, I couldn't wait to spec out my plan to Jimmy and Frank. We rendezvoused at our private office to flesh out the details. I felt like Lee Marvin in The Dirty Dozen. This caper would be epic, and it had to be done right, with no screw-ups. It had to look authentic, after all. The Roman Catholic Church owns the entire exorcism franchise, right? And with so many priests hanging around, they'd spot a fake black mass as fast as they could make the sign of the cross. Jimmy already had a set of keys to every door in the school. We had to select a room for the mass. That was easy. A theology class. Every mass needs an altar. The teacher's desk would be perfect. Now what about a blood sacrifice? We didn't know any virgins, other than ourselves. And we didn't want to hurt anyone. Just cause a little havoc. So for a sacrifice, I suggested a fetal pig. First, it was already dead, so it was no more cruel than a ham sandwich. The bio lab had blue plastic drums of them, floating in formaldehyde, just like Jeffrey Dahmer. A shoebox lined with red satin. That'd make a proper coffin, and Frank's sister sewed her own dresses, so that was easily sourced. A couple of burning votive candles boosted from the chapel would flank the pig coffin to add the hocus-pocus vibe. We could draw a pentagram right on the desk. The plan was shaping up. But how else to art direct the scene? The cross had to be hung upside down. But there must be more. I visited the big library in Jamaica, Queens, and found a copy of the Ritual Romanum. It had a how-to chapter for exorcisms in Latin. I copied down many lines, which I'd then rewrite on the chalkboard. For the final touch, just over the door on a metal platform was a plaster statue of a saint. It was probably 2 feet tall and heavy. Some monofilament line tied around him and attached tightly to the inside doorknob, well, that would create a safe and dramatic booby trap. We had a plan, a kick-ass plan. Over the next few days, we acquired all the materials and props. The fetal pig was last. They do throw off quite an odor. We figured the exact time to rig the room. We had 10 minutes between those theology classes, taught by a very devout priest who was fluent, as they all were back then, in Latin. We opened the door, then locked it from the inside, taped a sheet of paper over the window. We shoved the teacher's desk, which was quite tall, to the door. Jimmy jumped up on it and tied the fishing line to the statue. I scribbled Latin quotations on the blackboard. Frank pulled a pig from a plastic bag, laid it in the red satin shoebox, and sparked the candles with his Zippo. Frank and I slipped out the door first as Jimmy tied the line taut to the inside doorknob and shut the door, locking it. We locked it because we wanted that teacher to open it first and behold our handiwork before any student could and possibly be blamed. We were guys who pulled ethical capers. Right on time, kids began to gather at the door, unable to open it. Father Brady pushed through the crowd, fished his keys from his pocket. He unlocked the door and pushed it open. Father Brady froze in his tracks and spread his arms. Get back! Don't come in! Of course, all those kids gawked at the door, bug-eyed. Brady looked at the candlelit desk and the chalkboard with the Latin scriptures. He blew out the candles, blessed himself, and then left the room, locking the door behind him. He shouted that class was canceled. Jimmy, Frank, and I did a fast fade down a staircase. We did not want to be placed at the scene. We met up later near the subway entrance, high-fiving until our palms were raw. Our mission was a fantastic success. We laughed so hard we nearly puked. But we didn't yet know just how successful it was. The next day, gossip about the event had spread like wildfire. The entire wing where the room was cordoned off with velvet ropes. A brother with a brogue hot-footed passed and asked no one in particular, "Is this where the Black Mass took place?" Then I spotted something weird coming to the top of the stairs. It was green and glittery. Ooh, it was a hat. A bishop's hat. Holy shit, there's the bishop in full regalia. The robes, the 3-foot hat, the crozier. He had arrived to exorcise the wing of the building. In his other hand was the Ritual Romanum. I felt a tug at my elbow. It was Jimmy. His eyes were blazing. Tears streamed down his face. I thought we'd both have hernias as we tried to suppress our laughter. The Dean of Discipline showed up, told everyone to get lost. Nothing to see here. Move along. And so we did. We wanted to get a bullhorn and scream from the rooftop. We did that. But we never did. We told no one, which was a huge, maybe the biggest reason our caper was such a smash hit. Most guys cannot keep their mouths shut and convict themselves. Later that day, we went to our private room and shared a six-pack. Frank said he felt like he won the World Series, I told him. What we did was way cooler. We had no training, no coaches, no mentors, and no help. We did it all ourselves with nothing but our creativity, guile, and balls. An elite team, 007, would envy. That afternoon, I headed for the subway. I decided to walk home again. It was another chilly, windy autumn afternoon, fast fading into dusk. I just lived an experience that many guys crave but rarely achieve. A spectacular adventure, a caper of my own creation, pulled off with two great buddies. Nobody got hurt. A few fools looked even more foolish and had something to gossip and speculate and worry about. The student body got to tell a weird and creepy story to their parents just in time for Halloween. Maybe we should have been jewel thieves or safecrackers. There's a lot of fun to be had in life, but nothing tops the thrill of a successful caper. One so flawlessly executed that you don't lose any sleep worrying about being caught. We knew we were bulletproof. I've not seen Jimmy or Frank in forever. I've no idea where or if they are. I sometimes wonder if they think back on that wild adventure so many autumns ago. So what is it about autumn? Maybe it was autumn when I experienced a lot of great adventures. Maybe it's the chill in the air that quickens your step, heightens your senses. Everything seems more textured and vivid. Summer heat causes torpor. The sharp knives of deep winter cold make you want to hibernate. And spring is too wet. But autumn, the smell of burning leaves, the honks of Canada geese heading south across a creamsicle sky, the sight of a bishop flinging holy water around a desecrated classroom. Hey, thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. A special thank you to all those wonderful friends who support this show with their donations. Hop over to thatlarryshow.com for hundreds more episodes. While you're there, click the subscribe button so you never miss one. If you like what you just heard, send a link to a friend and leave a 5-star review wherever you download. If you really like what you heard, click the Patreon or PayPal button and join the Take No Shit Dojo. People tell me there's not a similar podcast to this in the world. That makes me feel good. When I began this adventure, that was my mission, to create something utterly unique. Without your assistance, the lights go out and the show's over. Follow us between episodes on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find links to those as well as an email address if you want to write. All at thatlarryshow.com. There's even a phone number if you want to leave a voice message. My friends, I hope your autumn is shaping up beautifully. May it deliver you all it has to offer. The sights, sounds, smells, maybe even an adventure. Come hang with me again this Wednesday or thereabouts, just in time for Halloween. And until that time, take no shit.